Welcome to the second hour, first edition here on WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yose, your host. Thank you for joining us for our second hour on this Tuesday. Either joining us or sticking with us for our second hour on this Wednesday. I'm tripping. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in this second hour on this Wellness Wednesday, Lamont Summers is here. He's assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He will have the media report. There's some stuff that we didn't get to last week that we're going to get to this week, as well as some new items. So that's all coming up in the media report in a little while. But before we get to Professor Summers, Kenyatta Moon is here. She's founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. She is co-host of Holistic Living. Today we're talking about holistic education, practicing peace for children in the classroom and at home. Kenyatta, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Before we get started, let's remind the listeners to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yose. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to, and of course, I will not. As I said before, we are talking about holistic education. There is a conference coming up in September, Helping Our Children Be Their Best, that is going to be sponsored by the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought and Kenyatta Moon. Let's talk about, before we get into the substance of today's discussion, let's talk about what that seminar that is all about in September.
Yes, and it's so great because today's topic really touches on it, because we are recognizing that we're getting back to school time, and it is time for parents and educators to think about how we are this year going to help our children to be their best. They're already great, so what can we do to facilitate them being their best? And so at this interactive summit, it's going to be really amazing because we'll have, WEAA's own Changa Bell will be there.
Yeah.
He'll be one of our facilitators.
Host of the Relationship Experience.
Yes, we are so excited for what he'll be bringing. We will have esteemed author Dr. Stacey Patton will be there. She'll be talking about conscious disciplining. And so we're going to have a lot of workshops and, most importantly, some takeaways. So this will not.
Someone else is going to be there, too, I think.
I think there's going to be a special moderator, Sean Yose.
That's Sean
Yose. First Edition. So it is going to be an amazing time. And what's so great is that this is not just going to be about talking. We are going to be getting down to the nitty-gritty. We're going to be doing activities, and parents and educators, grandparents, anyone who is invested in the education, care, and upraising of our children will want to attend this summit and receive what they're going to learn and gain from it, and we'll have awesome takeaways that they can take into the classroom and into the home to help our children be their best.
Absolutely.
So exciting.
It is exciting. and it's exciting to look at this through a holistic approach. Dr.
Yes.
Patton's book is in some ways controversial, but mm-hmm. at the same time, not to me. Really looking forward to hearing what she has to say in that interview format with me during this conference, because, disciplining children is a, well, you know better than most, disciplining children and the practices of disciplining our children are incredibly important to the development of our young people, right. and has literally an impact on them for their entire lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, and the thing is, from a holistic perspective, we are, the focus of what we want to do is think about how we can raise our children, how we can guide our children so that the models of discipline are so far down the line. We are giving them tools to help them make better decisions, to help them see things more constructively, to think more critically when in situations where they have choices, and to feel more autonomous within their own decision making, so that the discipline should be a very, very last step. And right now we know, I mean, it's sometimes our first resort because we don't know always what to do. And so I'm really excited too. I think it's going to be such a great conversation. And I know that you're going to do such a great job with your interview with her. I mean,
I'm going to do the best I can.
We're going to have a ball. I'm so excited.
That's coming up in September.
Mm-hmm. September 30th, yes.
September 30th.
Yes.
Okay. So this week, though, we want to talk about creating creative spaces for our children, how we can create context for them to thrive as far as self-expression, quiet, and nature is concerned. So let's break it down.
Okay. And one thing I do want to say to our listeners is that this is not just a conversation for educators. It's not just a conversation for parents. Because you know me, I'm really, really big on this village raising the children thing. This is, you know, not just a phrase that we throw around. This is real. And people who have been parents at Inseroma, people who are in the community, we know that that is real and it is necessary. And so to those listeners who do not have children, or whose children are grown, this is an invitation to hear something that you can take and use to help your neighbor's child, to help the child at church, to help, you know, your sister or your brother's children who may need some support, and maybe they don't have access to this information, or maybe they do, but they're overwhelmed. Because I'm telling you, our parents in the community are feeling alone a lot of times. And so it's really a call to get back to this community essence. And again, this is bridging on the conversation we had last week, dealing with peace in the city as a part of the movement that was going on, or that is still going
on. Absolutely.
And again, the message there is community. Getting back to our roots, getting back to where we care and take care of each other.
I want to make a comment about that, Kenyatta, because we talked yesterday. Our friend Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival is in here talking about the film that is going to be shown, documentary that's going to be shown at the Parkway on tomorrow, the documentary about the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. By Brother Stanley Nelson, former professor here at Morgan State University. And the essence of the Black Panther movement was community.
Yes.
And I don't think it's hyperbole in the least to say that the Baltimore ceasefire movement was at its essence that type of movement. It was about the community saying we have to change and we have to do something different. We're not looking for the government. We're not looking for law enforcement to do it for us. We're not looking for external forces because they're not coming to get us. Mm-mm. And it was about the community saying, we're going to do it.
That's right.
And it was about the community not just saying, okay, everybody put your guns down. That would have been an ill-fated effort to just simply say that. What the ceasefire was about was engaging the community, was engaging the young men on the corners that so many people tend to be afraid of. And in engaging them, we know for a fact that they are not the monsters and demons
right.
that people try to paint them as.
Right.
They're young men who have thoughts and feelings and insights about their plight, and they express them on many, many, many occasions. 170 people in one location got their records expunged during the ceasefire weekend. The devil is a liar when he says that somehow it wasn't a success and somehow, you know, it was a failure. Just that in and of itself, raising the vibration,
yes.
the energy
yes.
in the city. This is the essence of what community building, community organizing and community action looks like. And I believe in my mind, it is reminiscent of what the Black Panthers did in the 1960s and 1970s. And we shouldn't be afraid to say that. We should demystify what the Black Panther movement was all about, because at the essence of it, as I stated earlier, it was all about community.
Yes. And what is community made up of? People. It's the people. It's each individual standing up and saying, you know what? Enough is enough. You know, like when Erica talked about that, like her son was complaining or
that we were going to set a record.
Right. And then she was, you know, upset as we get. And then she just said, well, what am I doing? You know, and that's what each of us, every person who participated in that weekend had to say, you know what? What am I doing and what will I do? And so it starts really with each of us individually, each person, and then we become that collective, we become that community. And so for our children, it's no different. In fact, this is where it starts, because every 15, 16, 17-year-old that is on that corner, of course, was a child at one point, and many of them did not, they were not reached. And that is the problem. That's the thing that we really have to be clear on, and we have to be honest about, and we have to seek change. And I think that for me is my purpose on the planet. You know, my purpose is to work with young children so that they, I know at least at one point in their lives, I was there to help reach them. I'm helping to help parents and other educators and other people who are vested in children to gain tools so that we collectively can do something different with our children, because we've got to change the narrative of how we're treating our children now. And so with this idea of peace, right? So we talked about it in terms of how it works for adults, but our children, they want peace too. And really, when we look at these school environments, I think sometimes we forget that when we're hearing all these crazy things going on in the classroom, there are many children in that classroom who are not acting out. And even those who are acting out are calling out.
That's an important point. That's a really important point, because we hear the stories. The story that stands out is a kid threw a chair.
Right.
But if there's 25 kids in the classroom, 24 of them didn't throw chairs.
And let's say more like 32 children in a Baltimore City classroom. Right. But yes, you're right. The rest of them didn't throw chairs. Or, you know, some of them, and I've heard about children who are sitting in classrooms and want to learn, but they can't because they can't hear the teacher, or the teacher can't reach them because of everything that's going on. So there is a real call for peace within the classrooms. There's a real call for peace within the homes of our children. And so today, just a few tips I want to share that we can talk about how we can create space for our children. So this is, again, about being creative. We always have to be co-creators in our children's greatness. And so the first idea is to create a space for self-expression. So this deals with using art as a form of self-expression. And no one has to get, you know, become afraid if you're not an artist. I'm not, you know, I'm a self-proclaimed artist. I think we all should be. But you don't have to be an artist. You just need blank paper. And if you don't have paper, you can tear open that cereal box, use the inside of your paper grocery bags. Be creative. But get some crayons or some paint. Paint is wonderful because it's a texture that children really sensorially get to grow with. And allow your children to create art. Most people may not know this, but often coloring or in any form of visual art is a mainstay for how you can reach a child, or really even adults, in therapeutic settings. There's something about when we are creating with our hands, creating art, that allows us to lower some form of defense. And through that, you're more able to reach your child. So if we just take some time and sit with our children when we see something is going on, well, what is happening at school? He's not telling me, but I know something's going on. Or why is he withdrawing when at the dinner table? Why am I not hearing from my child? Start doing some art with your child. Allow him to paint. Allow him to color. Allow him to build. And while he's sitting there, do it with him. And if you want, start asking those questions and pulling it out.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host on Wellness Wednesday, winding down our Wednesday show. Kenyatta Moon is in the studio. She's co-host of Holistic Living, founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. We're talking about holistic education, practicing peace for children in the classroom and at home. Let me take a phone call real quick, Kenyatta. Let's go to Carla in Baltimore, who has a question or comment. Carla, you're on with Kenyatta Moon. How are you doing?
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Great.
Thank you.
So yesterday, I I came home from being away, and my neighbor's children and another neighbor were outside playing, and they were playing this discipline game, and it was really, really sad to me. And I kind of watched them to see what they were doing, and then at one point, when the taller girl had a stick and she was getting ready to beat or play to beat the youngest kid, and I said, "Wait a minute, y'all have to find a better way to play with each other. You can't do this. This mm-hmm. is violent."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was just like...
It's learned behavior, right, Carla?
Yeah, it's absolutely learned behavior, you know. And then, like, her sister was allowing the bigger girl, who was not related to them, to, like, have a stick aimed at her sister. I was like, no. Y'all have to find another way to play.
Mm.
Well, sis, kudos to you, first of all, for stepping up and asserting yourself and being the real community mama that you needed to be.
Yes, yes. You made a change, Carla, and that's what's so important most of all in that situation. And, you know, this is what we all have to do more of. And I think... you know, therein lies some opportunity. So when we see this, because you are not alone in seeing things like this, we can start to think about, all right, next time I come home, what kind of game can I show them? And the thing is that we, the adults in the room, we have like a plethora of games from our background, from our childhood,
true,
that were outdoor games, and they were fun and they were inexpensive because we didn't have any money, right?
Right.
So, you know, maybe even think about some things that you can start to say, you know what, let me show these girls how to double dutch or this game or that thing. You know, I'm not saying that this is something you can do all the time, but just maybe think about something that you can show them. Because you've done the best first step that any of us can do, which is to care enough to say something. And so maybe a next step would be to bring something in that they can channel attention and energy towards, and they can look forward to, you know, when you come home, you might have something special for them.
Carla, thank you for your comment. If you want, you can respond if you want.
Thank you so much. And I wanted to say, as far as the weekend, well, I mean, I'm a djembe drummer. Me and a group of sisters,
oh,
we drum.
Love
and we most of the time we practice over at the Forest Park Senior Center, but this past Friday, a group of us, as well as the brothers who help us to learn some rhythms, we were over at Druid Hill Park over by the greenhouse just playing. You know, it was just so, we played until like 9 o'clock at night. It was just
That's
so
dope.
Awesome.
Awesome.
So I guess we kind of like brought the ancestors in on Friday night.
Ashe, good Ashe. Job, sis.
Amen. Kyle, yes. Thank you, sis. We appreciate you. So let's go back, but that's an important testimony
mm-hmm.
that Carla gave.
Yes.
So what is the next step we want
right.
to implore here?
So speaking of art, and I'm glad Carla brought up djembe drumming, because that was the next thing in terms of creating a space for self-expression. Move with your children. So again, another thing, and this combines our need for being more active. And you notice all these things are what we're doing with our children. It's not telling them to go off and do it. So, you know, our children may like music that we don't like or whatever, but allow your child to pick the song, the first song, and y'all just start dancing, just start moving, be free, be fun, be silly. And then maybe you let them play one or two songs, and maybe you bring in your Stevie or whatever and show them how fun you can be. And so the reason for this, and the reason for suggesting parents and children do this together, is because it's that proverbial letting down of the hair. It's that lowering of the inhibitions and the walls, so that there can be more relating, so that when you're ready to talk about more serious things, you're starting to build a different relationship with your children than they may have with you on an ongoing basis. Now, the second one is creating a space for quiet. And if you know me and you go to my school, you know that I'm an advocate for minimizing TV watching. I know that, you know, some families do that in the evening. So maybe try to start with swapping out one 30-minute show for some quiet time in the home. And it doesn't have to be for meditation, although trying to bridge in towards meditation is going to be so helpful for every family member. But the start of it can be just creating quiet spaces. Even one thing that I do with my daughters is we walk around the house and we lower our voices, or we'll speak with whispers. We'll have moments where we'll do this in time frames, because we can be loud because we like to have fun. We're really creative in the home. But sometimes we have to bring it back to center. We have to bring our voices down and try to practice that peace, especially if I see them getting a little chaotic with each other. So creating that space for quiet. And then the third one, and I'm rushing through now, would be creating a space for nature. And again, we forget, I think, sometimes in our hectic movement, what it was like to be children of our time.
And I think one of the things, and we don't have a lot of time, that we also forget being in Baltimore is that we have some of the most amazing natural spaces, green spaces of any city on the East Coast.
Right. I rocks with Druid Hill Park. Like, that is where she was just, where our sister just said she was, Carla. Like, that is, to me, I mean, that's our Central Park, right?
It's right. It's the same man who designed Central Park designed Druid Hill Park.
I love how you just know all facts about Baltimore City. So, you know, get out into nature. Let your children take their shoes and socks off on some clean grass. Please let it be clean grass. Get your hands in some mud, garden together, run around, play ball, do things out in nature where they can remember what childhood is like. And you can too, because we, again, with our schedules and all that we have going on, we try to like pencil in vacations and things. But really, within this great city, we can find many, many areas for release. And that connection back with nature helps to instill peace within children. And so, again, we're rushing through right now, but these are three basic starters that we can all do to work with children that we love or care about and offer some opportunity for them to work at gaining peace in their lives. And this is something that can be done. These are things that can be done in the classroom as well as in the home.
We are engaging in a series of conversations about holistic education. This week we talked about practicing peace for children in the classroom and at home. And we are engaging in these conversations as we lead up to helping our children be their best. It's a summit that is coming up on September 30th at New Shiloh.
At New Shiloh, yes.
And Changa Bell, Brother Changa Bell, is going to be a part of that, the host of the Relation Shift Experience, as well as Dr. Stacy Patton, the author and professor here at Morgan State University as well. So we're looking forward to that. And again, these conversations are going to lead up to that very important summit taking place at the end of September.
Yes.
Kenyatta Moon is the founder of the Inserome Academy for Holistic Thought, co-host of Holistic Living. Kenyatta, good to see you. Thank you for coming through.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Lamont Summers will be here. He is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He has the media report. Stay tuned. The questions and the summertime moves, as Dre says, summertime, get it? Lamont Summers is here. He is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. We have questions. He has the answers when it comes to media. He's in the studio. Professor, welcome back.
Glad to be back. Glad to be back in living color.
In living color.
In technicolor.
Technicolor. Yeah, all right. We've got a lot to get to. There are some stories from last week that we didn't get to, and I want to get to them in a moment. But this jumped out at me. The movie Detroit, which is supposed to be very, very good.
I saw it yesterday. I made sure to see it because I knew we were going to talk about
it
today.
Right.
So I made sure to see it yesterday.
So what are your thoughts about it? I have not seen it yet. I'm going to go see it.
Well, first of all, as somebody who I think I was how old was I? I was this was 1967, the Algiers Motel hotel incident or motel incident. I think I was 15.
Okay.
So I was very much aware of what was happening in Detroit. Because growing up in Cleveland, we also had a similar type of incident, not involving the same facts, but involving confrontations between the police and a black nationalist group led by a guy named Fred Ahmad Evans. And Carl Stokes, the first black mayor of a major urban city at the time, he was mayor at the time. And what he did, he pulled all of the white police out of the area where the sniper shooting was taking place. And he only sent in black cops. And at the time, the police commissioner was General Benjamin Davis. I don't know if you remember that
name.
Benjamin O. Davis, right. He was the a police commissioner. And so
Benjamin Davis was the police
commissioner? Junior. Junior was the police commissioner. And Carl Stokes called a lot of criticism for that. But he said he did that because he wanted to save lives because he thought that by having white cops in there that it would just further escalate things. And things did eventually lead to a peaceful resolution. I mean, the snipers were arrested and they were tried and convicted. But there were no further loss of lives. But after that, Stokes did not run for re-election. And in fact, they said his chances for re-election was pretty much nailed after that.
Story.
But I only give you that kind of context in terms of what was happening in Cleveland at the time. And I think this was 1966 or 67 to sort of set the stage for where I come in and watching the movie and very much vividly remembering what was happening in Detroit, which is just 5 hours from Cleveland by car. So I have to say that I thought that, first of all, the filmmaker is Catherine Bigelow, who many of your listeners may know from Zero Dark Thirty and, of course,
one of my favorite films,
The Hurt Locker. Mm-hmm. She's an outstanding filmmaker. I mean, I think she won an Oscar for The Hurt Locker.
Zero Dark Thirty was great film.
And I agree. And so I think, I mean, she's an outstanding filmmaker. Anthony Mackie is in it, along with, the cast is a wonderful cast, super cast. They primarily, however, focus on what happened at that motel. And the acting is riveting, is outstanding, both African Americans, both the teenagers or the young men, as well as the police.
Laz Alonso plays John Conyers.
Yes. And there is, he's in it, and in fact there's a scene that shows him talking to the crowd, and he's trying to get the crowd to settle down, but the crowd's not having it, but. One of the criticisms that I found in watching the movie is that there isn't much representation or much of speaking representation with regard to black women. Mm-hmm. And that's been a criticism of Jemele Hill of ESPN. She wrote a piece, I think, in The Undefeated, I believe, in which she criticized, and she's from Detroit, in which she said, and actually she interviewed her mom. Mm-hmm. And her mom was actually alive and a young woman at the time when this was going on. In fact, she lived not too far from where the shooting and the rebellion was taking place, from the center of it. And so Jemele was saying in her piece that she thought that the movie did not, and she hadn't seen the movie at the time, because I did see it yesterday, I agree with her criticism that the voice of black women by and large are not represented in that movie. I mean, there's a few scenes where you hear black women saying speaking, but it's not, they're not the center. The movie is still centered primarily around white voices, around the police officers and the young men who were detained, and what happened to the young men who were at the motel.
Well,
but
it's such a just a travesty historically when you think about how integral black women's role was, black women's roles were in the civil rights movement. Sisters played an absolutely integral role in the civil rights movement in many ways. They didn't necessarily get some of the historical accolades when we look at the history books and how history is depicted in the United States as black men did. But if you look at the real history of the civil rights movement in the United States, women, black women, sisters were an incredibly important part of that narrative. So they missed the boat on that. But they also missed, well, some people were criticizing the fact that you mentioned Catherine Bigelow, a white filmmaker, white female filmmaker, and the screenwriter, Mark Boal, were both white. And people were asking questions, why is that? Why are two whites really in charge of the creative process of bringing this film to life?
Well, you know, certainly Bigelow has a track record.
Absolutely.
I mean, she has a track record. And of course, in Hollywood, one of the oftentimes when you are trying to pitch a movie, they're going to look at your track record. They're going to see, well, what can you, I mean, have you, do you have a record of putting out quality work that's also commercially successful? And so she has had that kind of attention, at least with the two movies I mentioned. Even though she got criticism for Zero Dark Thirty for some of the stuff
because of political ramifications of it.
But she has a track record and
absolutely,
but
very talented.
And you know, Michael Eric Dyson, who's also from Detroit, in responding to the criticism of her being a white director, a filmmaker, and the screenwriter being white, he said that he thought that. If it's going to bring a broader audience to the theater, mainly, I assume he was talking about white folks, white viewers. If it's going to bring white viewers to the audience to watch the movie, to bring them into what was happening in 67, and so they can then hopefully relate what was happening in 67 to, and then jump forward and fast forward as we move towards 2017, it's a good thing.
Well, I would say, this is what I would say. I don't think that a black director or black screenwriter should inherently direct or write films about black people. I don't necessarily think that's true. However, the reason why I have the caveat here is because Hollywood has been so terrible when it comes to diversity, as far as allowing black screenwriters and black directors direct and write films that are, quote, white films or films that don't have a theme that is more connected to people of color. Because a screenwriter, if you're talented, you're talented. You can write about any subject, but you know what we don't see in Hollywood is we don't see the reverse. We don't see black writers and black directors typically directing films that are set thematically connected to white Americans or white people more. So until we get to the point where there's more diversity and there's more reciprocity, if you will, in this area, then I understand the criticism. I mean, there are incredible black filmmakers and screenwriters who could have written Detroit. Now, Antoine Fuqua jumps out in my mind immediately. Now, maybe he was on another project. Who knows? But there are many, many others who could have done Detroit and done it well, quite frankly. So.
Well, also, there's the argument that when you have a white filmmaker pitching a story like this, that the suits in Hollywood see that as more legitimate. It brings an air of legitimacy to it. In that here is this important filmmaker, acclaimed filmmaker, who wants to do a subject like this. And, you know, in the theater, I actually went to see an afternoon showing yesterday, and there were some white folks in the audience, and there were scenes in the audience, and the police don't come off looking well, as they shouldn't. I mean, as they should. I mean, they shouldn't come off looking well. They come off looking very, very bad, real bad. I mean, it was at times it was even hard. It wasn't hard for me to watch. But even for me, there were scenes that for me were just riveting. I mean, just to watch how it was depicted. So she didn't cut any corners in terms of depicting the level and the gravity of injustice and criminality that was visited upon these African American men at the Algiers Motel. So she didn't cut any corners. She didn't spare any expense in terms of cinematically. But yeah, I did overhear in the back in the role where there were some white film goers sitting there. They would said, "Oh, they were gasping and they were, you know, they couldn't believe what they were seeing." And some of them, I heard one or a couple say that they did not like this movie, okay. especially during the scenes, during some of the more graphic scenes that took place at the hotel.
Try being one of those brothers who was caught up in that Algiers hotel. So you got to put it in perspective. I remember the reaction of some white people who came out of 12 Years a Slave, and the one woman, a woman crying, I mean, just ripped apart because of the intensity of the film. And the cat who was consoling her, I suspect it was her boyfriend or husband or whatever, saying it was a long time ago. And I remember thinking, not really. But, you know, that's a whole nother scenario.
You know, if I was thinking as I was leaving the movie, if I had been, some years younger, I would have left that theater enraged, ready to do something. Mm. I'm serious.
Well,
those are the kind of feelings that I felt at times watching this movie. And I think the fact that I'm much older and
you don't want to get caught up.
Right. I'm much older. I'm a professor now.
Right, of course. of course.
Lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. Right. But even with all the credentials I have and with the years that I've got being long in the tooth, as they say, that movie still unlocks certain basic, raw kind of feelings in me.
It's interesting. I remember when Do the Right Thing came out, and the criticism and the fear of white movie critics in particular. I remember one writing, I can't remember which one it was, but it was one of the prominent film critics saying, it's like having dynamite under every seat. This film is going to cause a riot. No such thing happened. There were no riots. There was no violence in movie houses because of Do the Right Thing and the climax of the story. But it's interesting that you made it plain that this movie pushes some buttons.
I like to add, though, the movie is not doing well commercially. So
yeah.
I think it only took in $7 million during its first opening weekend, and so which was lesser than it was projected to take in. So it's not from what reports that I've been reading in terms of commercially at the box office reports, it's not doing that well.
Yeah, you know, people. I mean, it's probably because of the response that the white people that you watched the film had. They didn't like the movie. They didn't want to see that. They don't in Trump's America. They don't want to hear this stuff. I'm not disparaging them and necessarily painting them with a racist brush. But I'm saying, you know, it just the atmosphere in which we live, the possibility or the opportunity to have frank discussions and conversations about race. This is not the atmosphere that I believe fosters that type of environment. I mean, another to juxtapose Detroit with another black themed film with a white writer. Girls Trip,
right.
Has broken all kinds of records.
I was about to mention that. Yes.
I mean, you know, people want to see that. They don't have a problem seeing that. But when you start talking that race stuff, they don't want to get down like that. You know, some people don't. I'll say that.
And then, of course, you know, the thinking behind a lot of the thinking, stereotypical thinking among Hollywood executives, is that when a film like this does come along, rarely as it does, if it doesn't do well at the box office, then that just fulfills. Then the studio execs say, "Well, we tried, so we won't be making that for a while."
Yeah, and to the detriment of black filmmakers and black people, right. Who want to see these types of stories be told.
Yes.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host, winding down a Wellness Wednesday here on First Edition. Lamont Summers is here. He's assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. We're in the midst of the media report. Let's jump back. I know it's a couple of new things that we got a lot of good stuff again this week, Professor. But let's jump back into a couple of things that we didn't get to last week, and that was Fox News. One of the things was Fox News. Another scandal. Yet the numbers keep going up for Fox. This is an interesting scenario with this news organization. This network. The more the scandals, it seems like they don't lose listeners. They don't lose watchers.
Yeah, Eric Bolling, who is the host of the show The Five, which was a replacement show. I believe that was a replacement show that replaced Megyn Kelly's show. that he recently was suspended by Fox for allegedly sending some lewd text messages a few years back to three women. The messages included pictures of a male genitalia. And so as a result of that that allegation, Fox News decided to suspend him. And this is interesting because in since last summer, when you look at all the things that have happened to Fox News since last summer, since sometime in July, you had the sexual harassment complaints, lawsuits, et cetera, allegations, in some cases lawsuits, of which there's still some lawsuits against people like the late Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes later resigned shortly thereafter. You have Bill O'Reilly. You have Bill Shine, excuse me, a major Fox News executive. I think he was president. You have Gretchen Carlson, her lawsuit. You have Megyn Kelly, who leaves. Gretchen Carlson, she's no longer there. You have a guy over at Fox Business News, Charles Payne. He's been suspended, or either he was suspended or fired because of allegations of sexual harassment. So you've got all these, you know, it just in about a year, a little over a year, you've got all these scandals, allegations, et cetera. And the ratings have gone up, according to Nielsen. Fox's news ratings, overall ratings, have gone up 18% this year.
Two words, Trump Nation.
I would say two words, three words actually, loyalty and trust.
In fact,
Fox News's ratings are still higher than CNN's and MSNBC's ratings combined.
Their ratings have
gone up. Rachel Maddow's show, her show is considered one of the number one shows right now on cable news. But yet still, Fox is the leader. Fox has been the overall cable news leader for almost 16 years for 16 years consecutive, 100 and something, I got to figure here, 187 consecutive months.
Yeah.
So, Fox viewers continue to be loyal. They continue to trust that network. And, of course, with Trump being very supportive of Fox News and Fox News being supportive of Trump, and Trump claiming that everybody else is fake news, or most everybody, all other media outlets are fake news, it's I think that's helping to help maintain Fox's leadership numbers, rating numbers, and also has grown its audience.
There's a couple of guys on Fox that have gone after Trump on more than one occasion, though. Chris Wallace is one.
Chris Wallace, yes.
And Neil, what's his name? Neil Caputo?
Neil Caputo.
Yes. Is another.
But not Sean Hannity.
That won't happen. I'll put it like this. The day that Sean Hannity turns on Donald Trump is look for impeachment papers to come in a matter of days. Trust me when I tell you that. Now, I wouldn't even say that. I would say he would have to be on his way out of office.
Mm-hmm.
The day that Sean Hannity turns on Donald Trump, the 45th president's his time is drawing to a close. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Hannity will never turn on him. So,
there are other smaller news outlets that's trying to compete or trying to build its conservative audience. There's one called America One or One America, Newsmax. They're another news outlet, conservative outlets, that's trying to build its audience, but none of them have the reach.
One America?
Yeah, One America.
One white America? Is that what it is? Because I don't know what America they're talking about. But
none of them have the reach that, in terms of, none of them have the availability in as many households as Fox News has.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that this only, I think this is a credit, and I use that term, very broadly. This is really a credit to the genius, quote unquote, of really the late Roger Ailes, because
here is
a guy that actually instituted a formula. He created Fox News in 1996, and yet he's long gone. I mean, he died early this year, I think, late last year. And yet the formula, Fox News continues to grow in ratings.
Well, Roger Ailes was a genius. There's no doubt about it. He was a twisted genius in some ways, but he understood race. He understood white people. He understood politics. And he understood the dark places of each of those subjects. And he tapped into it with expertise, and he laid a blueprint that they can continue to repeat over and over again.
There's a fascinating book that I would highly recommend to the listeners. It's written by Gabriel Sherman. It's called The Loudest Voice in the Room. And it really chronicles the rise and of Roger Ailes and his career and the number of people that he helped to shape their careers, presidents, et cetera. I mean, how he got his start he grew up in Ohio, Warren, Ohio. I actually, believe it or not, they're showing the Cleveland connection. He actually was in Cleveland at a time when I was still there. And I just finished high school. Mm-hmm. And I think he went to Ohio University, a school that I went to for my master's. He actually started off at a local Cleveland station, KYW, which later moved to Philadelphia, on a show that later became one of the top syndicated shows, the Mike Douglas Show.
I remember the Mike Douglas Show well.
But it started in Cleveland on KYW, and it was just no one thought that the Mike Douglas Show would really blow up. They thought they gave Mike probably 2 or 3 months. But no, Roger Ailes became like an assistant straight out of college working on the Mike Douglas Show. Mm. And from there he went on. I mean, he really helped to grow and develop Mike Douglas into the juggernaut that he became as a daytime television talk show.
Absolutely. He was on for decades, a couple of decades, syndicated all over the country. Let's go to another subject. Let's go to this HBO slavery drama, Confederate. I've heard on the periphery a lot of controversy connected to that.
Well, this is the creators of Game of Thrones, two white creators. They are pitching an idea to HBO, and HBO seems to be going along with it, in which they want to create a drama series, based on the assumption that the South, the Confederacy, had won the war, but it's pitched in modern times. So instead of the times that we're living in now, imagine what this country would be like if the Confederacy had won the war. And so what would conditions be like? I assume blacks would still be slaves. It's sort of a reimagining of history, according to these creators. So we can get at some of these historic and issues that we've been dealing with in society today. And so there's been a lot of, once the idea was became public, there was the immediate social media backlash in which the hashtag No Confederate was created. Mm. And so there's been a lot of criticism around this idea. On the other hand, there is a proposal by two black artists, Aaron Magruder and
– from the Boondocks.
Right, from the Boondocks. And Will – I can't think of Will's last name –
I know you're talking about.
I can't think of his last name right now, but they are pitching the idea to Amazon of doing a show called Black America, in which the idea behind the idea is that 3 or 4 states in the South would become black governed, black populated states within the United States.
Hmm. I'll raise my hand to go. I'll volunteer to go.
And you know, when I heard that, it reminded me of, I'm sure you remember, the Republic of New Africa, and one of the ideas of the Republic of New Africa, which was a black nationalist group pitching self-determination back in the '60s. What they were arguing is that they were saying that given the number of black folks that live in the Deep South, that we really should form our own nation within a nation and call it the Republic of New Africa.
Or One Nation Under a Groove, whichever one you like. I mean, you know. I always defer to me. I always go in the way of music, but that's just me.
I hear you.
I think that's it, probably. It. On that note, we should probably end it, Professor Summers. Lamont Summers is Assistant Professor of Media Law and Ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. Professor, always good to see you.
Good to be here.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Good. All right. That's it for us. That is it for First Edition. It is a production of WEAA. The show is produced by Executive Producer Sean Yoes, Associate Producer Iurio Digizua. Our board operators are Andre Melton and Ty Rice. First Edition interns are Isaiah George, Wyman Jones, Kristen West, Alex Blanc, Valentin Davis. Stay tuned for my main man, Changa Bell, host of The Relationship Experience, next, right here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I am Sean Yoes. Peace. It's the questions, yeah.